to run. Now they're holding steady, they are ready for it. Look, it has begun.
Come on, come on, Dover. Come on, come on, Dover. Come on.
That, dear listener, was a scene from the 1964 Hollywood musical My Fair Lady, which was itself based on a highly popular Broadway musical of the late 1950s of the same name, and which was itself based on a play by George Bernard Shaw from 1939, which was itself based on, or at least playing around with, the myth of Pygmalion, which was the name of the Bernard Shaw play, about a man, a sculptor, who disavows women as they actually are and creates a statue of a woman who the gods allow him to fall in love with, and then she takes human form and he marries, has children, and that's a happy ever after. The scene that we just listened to was part of that transformation, and as you may gather from the shouting, a not entirely successful transformation of Eliza Doolittle from a humble Cockney with a Dick Van Dyke accent flower girl in Edwardian England into a lady who could speak like proper English and had all the etiquette nailed down. That was part of when she was at Ascot. I thought it was rather funny, but you may disagree. Anyway, that's the start of our programme. I've introduced what the subject is going to be, My Fair Lady. Let me now introduce my co-presenter, Ms. Emma Burnell.
Hello. How are you, Steve?
Yes, thank you very much. And who I believe you did play Eliza Doolittle in a, did you not?
Sort of. So when I was a teenager, I did a summer school at Italia Conti, which is, you know, one of those young people's acting schools. And we did a kind of medley of loads of things from loads of different musicals, and everybody got a go. And so I did a piece by Eliza Doolittle and also one of the songs from Blood Brothers.
Right. Okay. Now, the reason why...
It would also be a fantastic subject for Zeitgeist Tapes.
Too many scousers. Scouse.
It was a song sung in accent. So a 15-year-old sort of North London girl pretending to be a 40-something-year-old Liverpudlian woman.
Go on, do a Scouse accent then. Do your Scouse accent.
I'm trying to remember. Once I had an husband, you know, the sort of chap. Came on with a smile and then he came on with the chat. He said my eyes were deep blue pools, my skin was soft as snow. He said that I was sexier than Marilyn Monroe.
Now do that with a Scouse accent.
Fair.
Okay. No, it was. I got some of it. My mum's from Liverpool.
This is, you know, if I was 15, this is 32 years ago. 38 years. Yes.
No. I mean, perhaps you could remember all the words more than anything else, frankly. I don't know what I could remember from that long back. But anyway, getting back to what we're doing, why are we doing it? I hear the listener asking themselves, why on earth do you want to, on a podcast which is meant to be about the politics of popular culture, why are you talking about My Fair Lady? You know, I mean, it's an often reproduced, restaged musical. It's still popular. They were going to do a remake of it. Emma Thompson had apparently written the script, but it just didn't happen. But the reason why is because I did see recently a production of it at Manchester's Palace Theatre, which has been subject to controversy when
the audience like.
Yeah, well, we can go into that a little bit, but it wasn't quite like the it's a Bodyguard, wasn't it, where they closed it down because the audience was singing. Well, I saw it recently in the Palace Theatre, and as part of my research, I thought, well, I'll watch the film because I've never ever seen the film, and I thought this is actually very. It's set in the Edwardian period, but there's a lot of contemporary stuff actually. I mean, there are issues here which sadly are still with us and unresolved. And I thought, oh, you could actually put a staging of the musical and in modern dress because and you wouldn't really lose very much, and you could tweak it a bit. So anyway, so there were kind of resonances there. And I also watched, because it was on YouTube, the play or the film version of the play Pygmalion by Bernard Shaw. So just to get a sense of how things had changed or indeed had not. So that's a proposition. There is some contemporary politics in all of this. But before any kind of criticism or any kind of taking apart of the musical, I've got to say, I loved it. I really, really liked it. Now, Emma, I can see Emma's nodding. No. Yeah, she doesn't agree. I'm sure she can verbalize her disagreement in good time, but I really liked it. Lerner and Lowe are really good in my opinion. They did Camelot, and actually that's the end of my knowledge of Lerner and Lowe. But that's two musicals which I really, really like. Emma, so you didn't like it at all
I
as a
really
musical.
I didn't like the film at all. I'd never seen it either, and I watched it and I was baffled by it. I mean, the plot makes no sense at all. The ending makes no sense, and there are about 17 of them. And it Like, I mean, I think I texted you halfway through my watching. I'll go, so basically, two old gay blokes tell a woman how to be a woman. Yes, I can see contemporary themes in that. But it was like the songs themselves are great. And I can absolutely see why when I did that showcase, we took a few of the songs out of the baffling musical and presented them separately. But and the costumes are wonderful. I'll give them that. The costumes are extraordinary. But the film itself, it doesn't hold together structurally. The story is minuscule at best, like very little actually happens. And what does happen makes no sense.
Right. So maybe we should take the listener through a bit of this, well, the story, just so they can sort of understand it. But to be honest, I mean, this is one of George Bernard Shaw's most popular plays. I mean, there was a time, there was a time when he was the clever playwright. He was always on the BBC. Plays were always being staged, and it's only like from the 70s when his popularity began to sort of peter out. Now hardly anyone does it. But the first thing is that Pygmalion, I mean, George Bernard Shaw was an alleged socialist, or a very odd socialist, it had to be said. But and his play Pygmalion, which My Fair Lady is the play plus music, I mean, it doesn't really change anything, is about, let's do this as quickly as possible, Professor Henry Higgins. Who is must be one of the richest professors I've ever come across. He's got a household of servants, doesn't
Definitely
appear to be.
genuinely wealthy, isn't he?
Yes, he doesn't even do lectures. No PowerPoint he's preparing. Anyway, he's a phoneticist, I think is the right phrase. And he comes across this gawky Eliza Doolittle, the aforementioned flower girl, who's got this, yeah. Dick Van Dyke Cockney accent, or did Dick Van Dyke get his Cockney accent from Eliza Doolittle? I don't know. And he basically, with his, he comes across another fellow enthusiast who, Emma suggests there might be a hidden gay subtext to this. I don't know. And he has a bet. And the bet is that he, Henry Higgins, can turn that damp or
Creature, as
squat
he
cabbage.
frequently calls her.
Well, yeah, that squashed cabbage leaf or baggage, or I mean, he's very derogatory to her. He can turn her into a lady. The proposition is that because she can't speak properly, that she's going to be condemned into her class position. But if you can teach her to speak proper, then the world is her oyster. And that's a kind of bet. And as Emma said, it's quite simple. They teach her how to speak proper. She goes to this ball where they pass her off as a member of, ironically, the Hungarian aristocracy, but anyway, a lady. They congratulate themselves. Eliza goes off in a huff. She doesn't really know where she is in terms of social standing. That's kind of an interesting point. And then she falls out with Higgins because he thinks it's his triumph, but she thinks it's her triumph too, and all of that. And it implies, the musical implies a certain romantic connection, which hadn't been there at all during the most of the musical. And then it ends on a kind of ambiguous note, on a semi-romantic slash what the hell's going on kind of an ending, which is also true to the play and is also true to the production that I saw as well, which faithfully reproduced all of that. So that's the basic storyline. So let's tear it apart.
I mean, as I say, it makes.
Where do you want to go first, Emma?
Well, I mean, it's it. So the thing that I will take in terms of the politics of it, if I'm being really generous, so I work for the Fabian Society part time, and George Bernard Shaw was part of setting up the Fabians, and the Fabians were the sort of middle class wing of the socialist movement that formed the Labour Party. And I did wonder if in Henry Higgins, Bernard Shaw wasn't sending up that kind of Fabianism. Oh, darling, wouldn't it be nice if we were all middle class? Which, is a big strand in Labour politics. Tony Blair's we're all middle class now. So I wondered if that was the intent. The gender politics, the sexual politics are appalling. This woman is entirely the creature, and is regularly referred to as just a creature of these two men's whims. Her father, an inveterate alcoholic, as far as we can tell, they then somehow contrive to get him sent on a lecture tour of America. Completely bizarrely, and he then has lots of money and so has to get married because his missus, the woman he was living in sin perfectly happily with, now that he's got money, wants him to make an honest woman of her. So he's getting married in the morning. That's another of the famous songs from it.
Which
It's
is when the audience at the Palace Theatre all started to clap, just completely spontaneously to clap the song as it was going on. Oh, and by the way, Ian Beale of EastEnders, I don't really know his name, what his real name
Edward,
is.
yeah.
He played Alfred P. Doolittle. But I wonder if we could just talk about Alfred P. Doolittle a little bit. You can tell I looked it up on Wikipedia because got the P in. But I mean, Alfred P. Doolittle, who is the father of Eliza, who is a feckless figure, a drunk, probably a wife abuser. He certainly goes off with lots of women. You know, this is at the start. And at one point, he actually kind of sells Eliza to Henry Higgins, right? Now, that's first of all, that's an interesting thing in itself because there's a kind of a subtext, which is very, very sub and completely taken out. Of the play that I the version of it when I saw, where she often says, Eliza, I'm a good girl, I am, and that's my approximation of the accent. And that essentially
Almost
she's
as good as
concerned.
my scouse.
Yes, indeed. But I've no pretensions on that front. That could have been a Scouse one, by the way. Anyway, we won't go down that. She says that at various points to make sure that nobody thinks she's a prostitute.
Yes.
There is something in there, and it's all very, very low on the down low. I mean, you've got to really know something about the period, really, and what's going on. But the thing about Alfred B. Doolittle trying to sell her, or actually selling her for £5, is that that's what happened. You know, That had been exposed as a scandal. You know, young working class girls were being sold on to richer men to be their concubines, to be their whatevers.
But
So does
in the judgment in the story, all of the judgment on that is on the seller, not on the buyer.
yes.
So, there, I mean, okay, Henry Higgins seems to have absolutely no sexual interest in Eliza at all, but
Yeah.
he is using and abusing her in other ways. And no
Yes.
one seems to think this is at all something that should be commented on, and he is very much portrayed as the hero of the story.
Well, his companion, Colonel Pickering, his fellow enthusiast linguistically, is there really to soften him. He's the one that actually is he's the nicer one, but nobody really there are some questions
He makes
about
an
it, but
occasional cup
nonetheless.
of tea while she's being tortured for 16 hours a day.
Yes. But anyway, back to Alfred P. Doolittle, because he there's a scene where he says basically, I am the undeserving poor, right? And in the Edwardian period, there was the deserving poor who the Fabians wanted to help, and all of that and charity. And then there was the undeserving poor. I mean, and George Bernard Shaw is doing something. I'm not quite sure what he's really doing with it, but that there are these working class characters who like to be drunks, who are happy, you know, not doing that much. And they don't want to be changed. They don't want to be turned into these Fabian model citizens. And that's the irony of him getting all this money because of these lectures, which is, of course, a silly device. And then because he doesn't want to be rich. He's unhappy, really, because then he's got to be respectable, and he doesn't want to be respectable. And I thought Alfred P. Doolittle was an interesting character because I wondered if he was being written up today, what would the likes of Lee Anderson and the rest of them think about this character? Because as the audience sees him, he's a lovable, you know, Cockney, likes a bit of a drink, likes to be lazy, likes to avoid work, likes to avoid his wife. And as I say, you know, that when he's doing the I'm Getting Married in the Morning song, everybody joins in. It's like, great. But it's actually saying, the lyrics of the song are, I've got to catch as many women as possible between now and getting married because I won't be able to do it after. Or to you know, that's summarizing the song,
Extremely unlikely.
essentially. Yes, well, anyway. So there is, I mean, you know, but you've got to really, the musical doesn't really go very deeply into that because it's not really interested in that kind of thing. But it is there. It is there. But it's kind of like a minor thing. But I think Alfred P. Doolittle is the most interesting character in the whole thing, even though he only appears about three or four times.
I mean, I think, as I say, I think when deconstructing it for its politics, that clash between the deserving poor that I suppose Eliza in some ways represents, what she wants is to set up a little shop and make good of herself. And that's
Yes.
why she originally goes to Higgins and says, you said you can teach me. I want to work in a flower shop and they won't help me unless I have a better accent.
Yes.
And the undeserving poor who do not wish to raise themselves up from being working class. And so, that class tension of is it okay, in Bernard Shaw's opinion, to not want to, have social mobility, as we call it now, is an interesting factor. There's also the difference between the rich and the aristocratic, some of which comes out in the character of Freddie, who is posh, raised posh. Has no good to him, wants and falls madly in love with Eliza, wants to marry her. It turns out he has no money. And she says, oh, I'll go and marry Freddie and I'll support him because he wasn't made to work. He
Yes.
doesn't do. That's one of the many false endings.
Yes. But yeah, and but she also just says she might become a teacher and teach elocution and
Teach
because
other
she's
girls to be
different.
as unhappy as she is, not knowing their place in the world.
Yes, and she is. I mean, there is a moment where she is unhappy, very unhappy when you know he's turned her into a lady, but then she doesn't really know, but she's got nothing to support her. And he says Doolittle says, well, you can marry somebody, you know, you can marry anybody you like. And she basically, well, that's something that, you know, we in the working class would never would have done. You know, we only marry for love. We don't marry for money. So turning the morality of the aristocracy and the rich sort of on its head a little bit. But yeah, I also wondered, I mean, in terms of how, because any awkward questions, of course, this is a musical, are not really addressed. I mean, but this is set in Edwardian England, but it's a lovely Edwardian England. Lovely, wouldn't it be lovely? And it's dire poverty, and yet they're all like jolly old characters. But I was thinking that's what got me thinking. Well, if that was just set in the present day, I mean, the song that she sings, wouldn't it be lovely? You know, all she wants is to be warm, have some chocolate, and have a room. That's a tragic. That's a tragic song, isn't it? I mean, but it could be a song sung by a young working class woman in London today, you know, without any change.
No, absolutely. And I mean, it shows, you know, the quote, the poor are always with us, not least because the rich are always with us, hoarding away the money. But the inequality in it is stark. And yet the starkness is glossed over by the cheery Cockney musical element.
Yeah, yes. I mean, you've really got to go looking for it, but it is there.
And you have to care, which most people have watched this on a bank holiday Sunday, just kind of going, oh, lovely musical, great costumes. Oh, doesn't Audrey Hepburn look beautiful? Doesn't Marnie Nixon sing beautifully? Because we all know that it's not Audrey Hepburn singing at any point. Rex Harrison, how he didn't get the singing double, I do not know. Because Harrison can not sing. In vague tune.
Yes, but he famous that he was famous for doing that. There's a German word for doing it like that, by the way. I don't know what it is. But no, he I think he won an Oscar. He won an Oscar for that performance. Please. I think it's good. I mean, I think he does the best song in the whole thing about I've grown accustomed to her face, which we might want to. I've grown accustomed to her face. See, I kind of talked that through a little bit. So yeah, maybe we can talk about this relationship between Henry Higgins and Eliza, because I think while it's, you know, it's problematic, as academics might say, it's kind of resolved in a way which is different to the Pygmalion myth, because as I said at the start, the Pygmalion myth is the sculptor disavows women as they really are. He actually hates women as they really are. And he creates this ideal that then takes human form and he marries her and she becomes his cipher. You know, he's created his ideal woman. Now, Henry Higgins kind of creates his ideal woman in terms of she's a lady, she can talk and act like a lady. But then when she becomes that lady, actually, by that point, Eliza has, having, it seems, looked up to him and almost kind of like romantically also felt attached to him to some extent. She realizes after he kind of basically casts her aside, after he's turned her into a lady, he's got no interest in her anymore. She basically says, well, you know, I mean, there's a song, Without You. I can live without you. I thought you were the greatest thing ever, but you're not. And I can have an independent life. So she kind of rejects him. Doesn't she?
Well, except he comes back and finds his bloody slippers for him.
Well, this is, yeah, I know, this is it. You see, she rejects him, and then he sings, I've grown accustomed to her face, or he talks it through. I really do like that one. It makes me cry sometimes. It's really odd. Anyway, but he's grown accustomed to her face, and that implies some kind of romantic possible, I mean, you know, thinking about her. At least he doesn't want to lose her.
That there is romantic interest there, possibly because they don't want us to be so blatantly obvious that he's gay.
Yes. We're probably homosocial.
Although I think he frequently uses the term that was regularly used as a euphemism in the day of I'm a confirmed bachelor.
He does call himself a confirmed, but I'm an ordinary man. That's in the song. I'm an ordinary man.
Why can't women be more like men? And it's like,
well, like a man,
what you're saying there, love.
Why? I mean, he says that to his associate, Colonel Pickering. Why can't a woman be more like you? to Pickering. And in the stage production I saw, there was a bit of tittering during the course of that song. But let us not lose the place about the end of the whole thing. In that song, he does say, "Why can't a woman be more like a man?" Which I thought, you know, is going to get some laughs. This, or people are going to go, "Oh, you know, making connections, you know, all that kind of stuff." Now, what they do, interestingly, in the song, "Get Me to the Church on Time," is they have it, it all kind of. There's a whole dance number, right? And Alfred B. P. Doolittle, Ian Beale, and some of his mates are all dancing with ladies of the night, some of whom are clearly men dressed as ladies of the night. And various saucy things go on between them. I mean, it's kind of, you know, if you're looking hard enough, it's a little bit risque, but not very. And they kind of introduce the whole trans thing, and then it goes into the song. And I don't know if it neutralizes it or I don't know, but they, I don't know why they did that, but they did that anyway. You're looking, I can see Emma's face here. You can't see it, listener. She's looking askance. That is what she's looking, askance, I think.
Isn't it askance?
I'm pronouncing it askance, right? And Budapest, not Budapest. He's a pest from Budapest. That's one of the better lines in the song. One of the songs.
I mean, it's yeah. As I say, the gender sexual politics are all over the place.
Yes.
And I mean, it was 1964.
Based on the 1913 play.
Based on a 1913 play. Based on a 1950s musical. It wouldn't have the same norms that we some have now. It wouldn't ask the same questions about gender and gender fluidity that we have now. So it was, you know, this is what a woman is, this is what a man is, I'm going to teach you to be a lady, and by that we mean a very specific type of woman. You know, when he's saying, why can't women be more like men, the qualities that women apparently don't have are all this fairly straightforward, level-headed, you know, camaraderie, all the things that apparently those silly little ladies can't do.
Yes, I mean, is that not, as it were, camping up misogyny? I mean, to make it sound ridiculous. Yes, yes.
Is it camping up misogyny to make it sound ridiculous? You might think that now, retrospectively.
Yeah.
I'm not sure that was true when it was written.
Yes.
I mean, I think it was written. He is written as a pompous, silly character.
Yeah.
But I think even so, that strand of thinking would not have been completely out of the norm. And also, you're thinking, yeah, this is a play written probably by someone who believed in universal suffrage, but at a time before women had the vote. So that we did have very different conceptions of what men and women could and couldn't do and shouldn't do. You know, Eliza works for a living. She sells flowers. That's how we meet her. But that wasn't common, certainly amongst non-working class women. Working in a shop would have been for a very lower middle class woman because you should be a homemaker. You know, either you're a homemaker or you manage servants.
Yes, yes. But to go back to the end, because the end is because the thing is, unlike most Hollywood musicals, the romantic aspect of this is either not present or hardly present. It's at the very, very end, Eliza, having rejected Higgins when he, in his moment of triumph, having passed her off as a lady. So that's his triumph. That's not her triumph, because she's just something he's working on. She's a thing. She gets annoyed, and she's upset and annoyed by that. And then he asks her, you know, Eliza, where are my slippers? Because he wants to go to bed. And she's so infuriated, she throws the slippers at him. And then she decides she's going off. She's leaving. So the slippers becomes like her independence. You know, she's thrown them back in his face. And at the end, after he's gone, I've grown accustomed to her face. And he's sort of got used to her. He doesn't want her to go. He's you know, she's left him and he's not happy. He wants her around. And then after her having run off and apparently abandoned him, then she voluntarily appears. And he says, Eliza, give me my slippers. And that's the end.
That's the end. And this is a classic.
Well,
baffling.
It's a non-traditional romantic relationship, or it's a not at all romantic relationship.
I mean, the romance subplot is with Freddie, not Higgins, generally.
Yeah.
Although she ends up living with Higgins, presumably in platonic bliss.
That's the thing for her. Her choice appears to be Freddie, this kind of wet lettuce, completely useless. But, you know, handsome and, you know, posh, but bloody useless, but totally devoted.
To the point where he's hanging out on her street at all hours of the day and night, ready for her to walk out.
He was stalking her, yes. And so it's either Freddie or Henry Higgins, who has got no emotions worth talking about. And I suspect, well, you know, Emma suspects his sexual interest is somewhere else, or is asexual, you know, which I think George Bernard Shaw, he was a very odd character in that regard. But yeah, her choice is between those two, and it's an extreme choice, really. It's like companionate or someone who's just lovey, you know, and just useless in every other sense. She doesn't really like him, it doesn't seem. She likes being loved because he doesn't. But that's her choice. Now, the end is odd. And it's the end of Pygmalion. It's the end of the musical. And it's still the end of the version that I saw, which is, you know, very, you know, faithful to all of that. But an interesting point, I did some research for this. This is about the only time I've ever done any research. And George Bernard Shaw was, because of the ending... Because that's what, you know, it's Americans say that, you know, it's sort of silly.
I did notice it in the credits. He's just Bernard Shaw. He's not George
Bernard. Yeah, but he's George Bernard Shaw. He's George Bernard Shaw. GBS. So the audience of Pygmalion, 1913 Pygmalion, was so foxed and befuddled by the end, because presumably they expected a nice romantic, it's all very conventional, ending. And they got something... that everybody presumably went, what? Like we did. Shaw decided to write an explanation as to what happened next. So it's kind of interesting, except, you know, if you've seen the film and everything, it's the clues are in there. So what happens is, he says, that Eliza and Higgins decide they can't live together. You know, he's not the marrying sort. She's in the house for a little bit, but it's not working out, really. So she does get married to Freddie. She gets married to Freddie. And thanks to Colonel Pickering, his largesse, she sets up a flower shop, which she always said she wanted to do. And I think she does a little bit of language teaching as well. And Freddie, I imagine, does absolutely nothing. You know, he's just posh and enamoured. And that's it. She doesn't. So she goes off and marries Freddie, which in itself is a bit odd anyway, isn't it? So that's the end that he gave to the end.
Well, as a playwright, I have to say that writing an ending after your actual ending is a massive bloody cop-out, which you can only get away with if you're famous as George Bernard Shaw was.
Sure, yes.
As it stands, it's quite right that he was asked to explain it, because it doesn't make any sense.
It only makes sense if it's weird. I mean, you know, and you go, that's not really how it should end. What kind of an ending is that, really? So yes,
one of those films I'd never got round to watching.
Mm.
No one had ever told me, oh yeah, it doesn't make any sense. Like, it's a really weird film. No one ever says that about it. And like, I'm watching it and I'm like, you know that feeling when you're like, am I the only person to have ever noticed how completely bonkers this is?
Well, you're not. You know, the Edwardian audiences have, you know, they scratched their heads. But yeah, it is, because I'd not seen the film. I mean, I vaguely knew about the storyline, but not really. And I assumed it ended with a romantic ending. And it's not. You know, I mean, in a way, that's brave. That's Brave Hollywood musical, not a romantic ending. But they try and have their cake and eat it, and it's just an odd,
totally.
it's an odd concoction. It's I don't want to have the cake, and I don't want to eat it either. So you can keep your cake. So it is odd. It is very odd. But the audience, you know, the Palace Theatre, they all, and you know, they were all happy. No, you know, it wasn't shut down early. Everyone was very, you know, very
We were
polite.
well
Apart from
behaved.
the
Clapping at a musical
Well, apart
is
from
well within theatre etiquette. Clapping along
yeah,
to
but
is well within theatre etiquette.
I didn't
When
approve
they
of the, you know,
sing
clapping
over
along.
the actors, that there's a problem.
No, the applause was supportive. I just didn't think it was, you know, it's a miserable old kit. I just thought this is how terrible. Anyway, so I don't know if you've got any more thoughts on My Fair Lady, which yes, I won't know. Just to say that in all of the versions I've seen, both of the play on film and the musical and whatever, and listening to the soundtrack of the original Broadway production, which I've listened to many, many times now, it's how ridiculous is the Cockney accent of all the female actors, whoever they are, and it's completely rubbish. And it is Dick Van Dyke, and it's an insult.
Worse
It's an
than Dick
insult
Van
to the
Dyke, and
Cockney.
that's saying something. It
Pardon?
really is. I think it's worse. I mean, that opening scene in Covent Garden,
Yes.
which is the least real set. I mean, you know, classic sort of 50s musical, I suppose that's the least thing that I'm going to criticize it for. But I mean, I could barely make out what she was supposed to be saying, and I'm from, I live in East,
Oh.
I have an East London postcode.
Yes, I mean it must have been a struggle for all of the female actors who perform Eliza Doolittle not to come out posh while they're still doing Cockney. So in actual fact, it's the struggle is the other way around.
One of the interesting parts was when Hepburn would, having been trained to be posh, would occasionally slip back into, and that was quite well
Oh.
handled. It's just that the accent she slipped back into was so bizarre.
Yes. Oh, yes. That's actually quite cleverly bringing us back to the start of the podcast with the clip when she's at Ascot, and she asks Dover,
The
"Move your
movie
bloody ass." Yeah, it's very. I think it's very. Anyway, on that bombshell, as it were, maybe it's time to. Just, I would strongly encourage our listener, even if you don't like musicals. I still think it's good. It's weird, but it's good. My Fair Lady. Or
it's really long as well. I
there's an
thought,
intermission. There's
oh,
an intermission. You can get a coffee.
I've got to watch this. I said I'd watch this for the podcast. 3 hours, I thought. 3 hours. I've just scared the cat
It's only £3.15 to rent on Amazon, so it's good value. It's £1 an hour, for goodness sake. That's
Also
great
free on
value.
Paramount Plus for those of you who
Oh
have.
well, oh well,
I get it
well,
free with
well.
my Sky subscription. So
Well,
I didn't pay for it at least, so I don't feel quite as bad as I would have done had I done that.
oh well. Well, I paid a considerable amount of money to watch it live. That's all I can say.
So, hang on, but just before we go, Adam Wood-Yatt was Alfred Doolittle. Who was
Yes.
Eliza and who was Henry Higgins?
I don't know. I didn't know who they were. I
They
honestly didn't know who.
weren't in the soap.
I don't know who they were. But a yeah, so but they were good. I mean, they were all right. They were all right. It was good. It was a nice but very traditional production. It wasn't pushing any, you know. There was a black policeman in the background. There were a few trannies on stage. You know, that was it. That was their concession. That was their concession. That was their concession. To modernity. I probably should apologise. I think by
Yeah,
the
I think
face that Emma pulled. That
so.
Emma pulled.
Danny is not an appropriate word to use, Steve.
I will echo that thought. So on that bombshell, possibly we should have ended up a
I think we've just been
bit
cancelled.
earlier. Just been cancelled. If we weren't there to be cancelled, yeah, how can you be cancelled before you're a thing? Come on. So anyway, I'm making my exit. I need to thank Lord Stuart Wood for the theme tune. I have to remind you that this is a political humour production, and if you want to rate and review, don't cancel us. Don't cancel us. Rate and reviews on whatever platform you may see. You may be hearing this from, and if you never hear from us again, you will know why.
Also, do follow us on Twitter, where we are ZT Podcast. And if you have suggestions for what we should be covering, we'd love to hear them.